and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is the pride of Kingston, Ontario, probably also of Kingston, Jamaica, if he'd ever been there, or a number of other places. Kingston, New York, why not? Michael Walker.
Stack them up. That's me.
I am Mark Bigney, your other co-host, and I have a special treat for you, So Very Wrong About Games listeners. I have taken out a mortgage on my board game collection, and consequently, we here at SWAG will be covering the tariffs for our American listeners for the next 2 weeks.
Nice.
After that, we'll have to work something else. Remember, you can't spell tariffs without FFS.
I just want to be clear. Covering the tariffs of games that we send you, not games that you order from somewhere else and get a tariff charge. You don't forward that charge to us.
We can't afford tariffs on actual board games. I meant tariffs on the show for importing the show across the board.
I just want to make, you know, all legal things aside.
Yeah. Send all legal requests, complaints, notices, and injunctions to support@aircanada.ca. We're going to be talking about board games this week. We're going to start off with the Eurus, the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment. We should get around to naming that. The game we reviewed last year. We're going to move on to the games we played last week. We're then going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And finally, we're going to talk about our topic this week, which is endgame scoring, the different kinds of endgame scoring, and mostly grievances we have historically. But then again, that can be applied to most of the show as it is. Walker, what did we review last year?
Exactly 1 year ago, Mark, we reviewed a game called Nidavellir. And in Nidavellir, you were sort of creating this tableau of cards from a drafting system and a very, very nice sort of bidding system. You'd have all these hidden bids and coins, and you'd be upgrading the coins, and then you'd be building this tableau of cards that combo together in some way to give you points.
Yeah, it's a very good filler weight auction game. It's not amongst my favorite. I commented last week that I think Albedo is my favorite blind bidding game, and that is definitely true. I prefer Albedo to Nidavellir, and they're both blind bidding games. They both also have a kind of pseudo-building mechanism. In Albedo, it's a deck builder, but in Nidavellir, one of the things that's cool is, though it's just currency, there is a kind of currency building system. There are a variety of ways to change the units of money with which you're bidding, and that part was the coolest bit. The least interesting part for me was what you're actually building on. There it was just relatively straightforward point-generating cards. Nothing particularly exciting happens there. It's been reprinted into a billion different languages. It's available on Board Game Arena. It was also redeveloped into a tie-in with a French comic book series called Nain, which is French for dwarves.
Gotcha. There's also another game on Board Game Arena called Mezos that has a very heavy Nidavellir feel to it, except it's cavemen.
Okay.
So same sort of thing. You're drafting all sorts of cards to build this tableau where the cards score in different ways, but there's no auction system. It's just this sort of, you're picking along the track. It's either getting one card from the top or one card from the bottom or left and right. But the further down the track you go, the lower when you come back to choose for next turn. And there might be some costs there the further down the track you go, as opposed to benefits the closer on the track you go. Anyway, we played a couple games. It seems all right.
Yeah, the Nidavellir is all right. It's a pretty good filler. I enjoy it. I would happily play it if someone suggested it. But again, the level of interest is primarily in the way the bidding and currency system works. What you're actually doing with it, I find less interesting and less engaging. The expansions, of which there are two for Nidavellir, strike me as vaguely successful. They're one of those things where it's like, yeah, I guess the game's a little bit better now. But at what cost, both economically and in terms of rule grit and in terms of length of rules explanation? So it's a bit of a wash.
And length of game as well, right?
Yeah, generally speaking. If for no other reason than the additional comprehension. Happily play it on BGA, I guess. It's one of those quick things. And if, you know, someone pulls it up and they've got to happily play it there too. But not a kind of thing that I find super compelled by. But all told, pretty well done. And Serge Leger doesn't tend to design too many stinkers. He's a quality, I guess the, what's the gender neutral term for workman-like? Workperson-like designer. I don't think that's going to catch on.
No.
Yeah. So that's Nidavellir. By GR Games, I assume that's how it's pronounced. Reprinted many, many times in many languages. And I can see why it's successful. It's cute. It's pleasant. And now, let's talk about the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, we got to get Flick Fleet back to the table. And this is a great dexterity game where you're flicking the dice.
And the ships.
And the ships, true enough. And so they're acrylic sort of cut ships that you the little diagram on your ship card will tell you where you can flick when you want to move it. So it's like sort of the back of the ship where the thrusters are.
Yeah, it's a game that cares where the nacelles are. It's great.
It's great. And usually it goes like spinning out of control because, you know, it's caught part of the table or you flicked it on the edge and it...
I had a bit of a destroyer problem. My destroyer spent the entire first two-thirds of the game facing the wrong way, which is an issue when you desperately need to cross the table because you can't make long-range shots.
So it doesn't give you that sort of space feel. It's not this gliding around, you know, space. It's more of a...
Yeah, no momentum, yeah. No sense of real heft. It's more... No, I mean, there's a little bit of heft. It's satisfying. Most of the ships that we played in our scenario, more on the scenario later, were roughly of the same size. But I assure you, when in your fleet you have both a dreadnought and a destroyer, I'm told... I don't really know anything about boats. I talked earlier in Furnace Time about sailing. I don't know boats. To me, destroyer sounds big. And cruiser sounds small. Anybody who knows anything about boats knows this is ridiculous. But if you've got both a dreadnought sounds big. I know that a dreadnought's big. And a destroyer on your force, trust me, you get a sense of heft from the destroyer versus the dreadnought in terms of how they move.
So you get to do a couple actions on your turn for each ship, and which usually means a movement and then shooting. And shooting for most ships are flicking a D10. So if you know how a D10 is, it's sort of a diamond-shaped object, and usually it's going to careen to the left or to the right, depending on how, and you have to hit your opponent's ship. And even if it rolls over, it's fine, but it can't leave the table. That's
bad. Which
is
often Walker's problem.
It's true.
He flicks with enthusiasm. I respect it.
And the other thing where it pulls in is that you need to roll... What comes up on the die face is also important. You need a 1 through 6 in order to hit, because that's how all the systems are. Because the other die that you usually roll to hit is a D6. Those are nukes, and so they're always going to do damage because they roll a 1 through 6. So the D10, you have to roll a 1 through 6. And that'll tell you what system is going to be hit. And it's usually like weapons or propulsion or something like that. And it's fairly basic.
Yeah.
You take it off, you no longer get to use that. You have other actions that you repair your ship. So you're going to be using up your actions for... You won't be able to move or shoot because you're now putting your shields back up. Or that's the other good part about the D10s, is that even though... If you didn't roll 1 through 6, if it happens to have shields, at least you're knocking down the shields.
Yeah, it's impossible to miss a ship with shields so long as you hit them physically. And as I've commented before, when I play a game with spaceships, I want them to feel like things with systems. I mean, obviously, this is not very complex at all. As Walker said, it's pretty straightforward. Most of the time, you're just going to be moving and shooting. But later on, as ships start to take damage, as systems start to fail, you do start to face these really difficult trade-offs about what to do with those actions. And I appreciate that makes them feel a little bit more like these big sci-fi capital ships, especially insofar as that tension of decision-making as well as the systems failing, making the ship feel like a little bit less of a ship and rather than being super fragile. The fighters are super fragile, and that's fine.
Yes, like Mark said, there's carriers that eject bombers and fighters, and they bring out more ships onto the table.
They eject them? Like a VHS tape?
Just so.
Okay.
And so you're flicking these big blocks of fighters and or bombers around that, you know, get destroyed quite easily, but if you get them into range, can do a lot of damage.
The one big drawback that I have... Well, I've got two drawbacks with Flick Fleet, because I think it's a brilliant design, honestly. Like, no bones about it. This is the kind of hybridization that we talked about in the context of Ascending Empires, but I think Flick Fleet does it much, much better. Obviously, it's less of a strategy game than Ascending Empires is, but just the sheer toyetic, glorious novelty and successful integration of dexterity elements into a traditional tabletop miniatures kind of setup is so well done. The minor drawback, which is kind of defensible, is how expensive the system is. This is a two-man and a garage operation, and I'm kind of locked into the deluxe ecosystem. You can get the deluxe version or the normal version. The normal version doesn't have any details on the acrylic ship. The deluxe one has etched details, including the name of the ship and the graphical flourishes. I'm stuck in the deluxe ecosystem. I can't mix. Mixing would be the worst of all possible worlds.
Gross.
Super gross. And you get a lot of value in a given box, a lot of different ships and a lot of different new toys to play with, but it is very expensive, and they crowdfund every few months or so. The more significant drawback, and I'm just going to have to stop trying them, is the scenarios are invariably, in my experience, super unbalanced.
Everyone so far.
Yeah, wildly so. Just the kind of thing where you look at it and you squint and say, really? That's what we're doing? Okay, we'll give it a shot. After doing that a bunch of times, I'm not giving them any more shots. I'm done with the scenario design.
I'm wondering if it's a campaign. And maybe it's one of these things where they
nope.
they flip. I know, but I'm just saying, and they flip. This is what I thought in my head.
It's a campaign. Okay.
I thought maybe they flip back and forth. It's like, okay, give it a little bit of advantage to this side. Next scenario will give it a little bit of advantage the other way. And it'll all wash out. But No.
So the scenario we were playing, I just picked one somewhat at random, and my side started off with 55 points worth of ships. Walker's side started off with 40 points of ships. On top of that, the one bit with the scenario was that there was this pre-existing minefield. The minefield is equally dangerous to both of us, and in point of fact, the existence of the minefield meant that one of Walker's ships, the mine layer, at the start of the game, could not lay any mines. And so on top of the fact that he had fewer points, he had an additional handicap, and Walker kept asking reasonable questions like, oh, maybe your reinforcements come in later? Nope. Maybe some of your ships are damp? Nope. It was so bizarre. Anyway, we played it as written just for gigs. And I think that's it. I think from now on, it's just, here, have some points, buy some toys. We'll set up at opposite ends. Goal equals murder. That's the way to do it. I mean, I'm complaining just because of how funny it is, really. Because an incredibly unbalanced scenario flick fleet is still a great time. You just have to not care about who wins. Because you get to see lots of really cool things with your ship happen. That awesome shot that never should have landed. You get perfect. The agony of the near miss. The hilarity of the ship going way off the wrong direction and now facing the wrong way. It's wonderful. I love Flick Fleet.
Flick Fleet is designed by Jackson Pope and Paul Wilcox and published by Eurodice Games.
No, Eurodice.
Eurodice?
It's pronounced Eurydice.
Eurydice Dice Games.
No, you're... Just a reminder for our audience of Walker's ethnicity, he is half troll. Got to play another game of Slay the Spire, the board game. At long last, we played Chapter 2 of our mini campaign, having finished Chapter 1 several weeks ago. This is an advantage of Slay the Spire. You can leave it for long times and come back to the existing campaign. Everything is pre-organized in the box. There's nothing really you have to remember. Additionally, Huey had been ghosting us for several weeks, and so we just decided to go on without him. Kicking somebody out of a Slay the Spire campaign? No problem. Requires zero modifications. Putting someone back in? A little more tricky, but we're willing to put up with it. We'll be willing to hash it out if and when Huey rejoins us for our Chapter 3. For those of you that cannot remember, I had a particularly busted combination right from the get-go in that I had a character that does lots of small attacks pretty cheaply, and every attack initiates an instance of poison, a mechanism that was already plenty strong in the video game and is even stronger, if anything, in the board game. I was able to execute an attack. I can't claim any credit for this. This is mostly just things that fell into my lap as a result of rewards that did 28 points of damage and a single card. For those of you that are unaware of the card game's damage scaling, your default attack does 1. So this was more than a normal attack would land. We breezed through the second boss with no problem, largely as a consequence, especially when you've just got this compounding interest of poison just accumulating and accumulating and accumulating. It was wild. But even when it's a blowout, still love Slay the Spire, the board game. It's super well done. I have to say, I just naturally found that the two games that I was going to be pitching for that night with the two Louis happened to both be by Contention Games, because I was thinking I had not played Imperium of Contention in a while, and so I brought that along in case we didn't want to continue our Slay the Spire campaign without all of the participants. But no, sure enough, Louis just said, you know, I really want to Slay the Spire. And I'm like, well, there's that Spire over there. Forget Huey. We don't need to worry about him being absent for a chapter of the campaign.
He's done several campaigns already, so it's not that, you know what I mean?
And more to the point, does he really deserve to Slay the Spire?
You're asking the wrong person.
I try not to be too judgy of someone's character, but, you know. Anyway.
Oh, I know.
That is Slay the Spire, the board game, our game of the year of 2024. Great time.
I got to play Alte, Dawn of Civilization, because it was pitched as a deck-building Civ game, and it delivered. I really enjoyed it. This is designed by Paolo Mori and Oli Steins, and put up by Ares Games. You get your starting deck, which is different than the other players. There's four factions, I guess.
Are they historical civilizations or made up ones?
Made up.
Okay.
Fantasy, almost, because one person, I guess, they don't have to be fantasy, but They're called small folk, so I guess maybe it's fantasy. I don't know. Anyway, so you get your normal, there's four different resources, you know, and then those four resources are also represented on the map because there's a map presence as well. You're building out these villages, and so you're trying to, you know, expand out because that's going to get you points. And then you're trying to upgrade those cards. You know, something gets you an apple and something gets you stone or metal or lumber. But there are better cards that you can purchase that will get you, also just get you wood. But if you own a forest, then you can get two wood.
Special wood.
Special wood.
Okay.
And things that will make you put out villages better and things that will combat better. And it plays very quickly. It says 45 minutes. Good luck with that. And it came with this odd Seafarers expansion, which I'm not 100% sold with. I'm not sure why it wasn't already included, and it just didn't play quite right, because you only get to attack things that are adjacent to you. And what Seafarers does, it opens up these two islands that are sort of in the center of the two sides of the map. And that means when you sail out of there, almost every other territory is adjacent to you. So when you attack, it gives you so much more opportunity. Whereas if there was no seafaring, it would be very sort of
constrained.
Constrained where you could attack. So whoever took those islands sooner very much, you know, took away with the game for combat part.
So what I'm hearing is you think that the base game is a little too narrow in terms of your attack options, but with the seafarers, whoever grabs those islands early has too many options.
I think so.
I see.
So you need, one could say that, well, you might not get the Seafarer card to come up much, but there's also these wonder cards that you're, or techs and or achievements. They, you know, they interchange these words often. Oh yeah, the rule book's terrible. There were several instances where I just read it out loud. It's like, okay, well, how would you interpret this? And it was just like, it sort of made sense what they were trying to say, but the rule book did not explain it that way. Anyway, so you're doing all these techs that will increase, you know, make you do things better, let you exchange resources or give you abilities every turn. So overall, I very much enjoyed it. I would recommend it. That is Altay, Dawn of Civilization.
I'll happily try anything by Paolo Mori. I'm very curious to give it a shot. We got to play another game of Wizards of the Grimoire Shifting Sands, a.k.a. Bookie Bookie Pew Pew 2, 2 Bookie 2 Sands. And this is a review copy we got from the publishers, Cole Banning and Joe Banning of Grimoire Games. And this very much confirmed our early impressions. So the Wizards of the Grimoire was the base game, Simpliciter, not Shifting Sands, Stable Sands, was very much a drafting two-player card battler combo thing, where the balance of the cards seemed to be mostly about direct damage, and then you would get some boosters. And my impression was that whoever was able to make good use of those booster kind of support utility cards.
Mana manipulation,
reducing cooldown, giving you more mana to fuel other spells, would therefore take the game by virtue of accelerating the pace of fueling their base damage cards. Shifting Sands seems to have a different balance. The bulk of the cards instead seem to be about mana manipulation, either manipulating where it is in your existing spells to affect the cooldown of yours and your opponents, etc., etc. And the minority of cards now is about direct damage dealing. Now, consequently, there's a lot more card manipulation and less damage being dealt. I could definitely see how this would appeal to a certain class of perhaps more Euro-curious gamer who want to lean a little bit more into the combo-tastic combinations. The problem is, at least from my perspective, from my preference, it can feel like some of the early rounds are a little bit slow going, especially when compared to Wizards of the Grimoire. That's a preference matter, though, and I could easily imagine if I'd been introduced in the games in the other order, maybe I wouldn't feel that way. Maybe I'd feel that Wizards of the Grimoire didn't have enough build-up. I'm not sure. But as it is, it feels like a very different game, consequently. Now, that's probably all for the good, because they're now two standalone games, and you can pick which one suits your preference better. It took a little bit of getting used to, though, as people who are somewhat experienced with Wizards of the Grimoire, Shifting Sands feels like it has a very different kind of tempo, a very different selection of spells involved. Unfortunately, in my experience sometimes, if in the starting flop of 10 cards, there's only one or two that's reliable in terms of damage dealing, if you don't snap those up right away, you could be in serious trouble waiting for there to be the opportunity for solid damage dealing. I don't know what the odds of that are. I haven't crunched the numbers, but there, I definitely feel like in our games, the advantage has gone to the person who's drawn more direct damage dealing spells.
Yeah, especially in the latest game, we're just sort of like hungrily waiting for the next card to be flipped up. Oh, does that one do damage? No, no, that just moves mana from here to there. No, this one just collects more mana. This one lets you draw more mana. Okay, well, maybe some damage is going to come soon. And so we'd wait.
Yeah, if anything, I think the sweet spot might be somewhere between the Shifting Sands and the base game.
Just mix them together.
Maybe, I don't know. I'd be curious to hear what the designers would have to say about mixing them all together. Maybe I should ask about whether that's a viable thing or a viable balance. Now, all of that having been said, comparing the original Wizards of the Grimoire to Shifting Sands, which I try to do to give people an impression about which of the two sets they might prefer, I still think that the core formula is super well done. I think it is a great way to get combos and drafting in a very, very visceral, quick package. Because so often, this happens all the time in games, not just Euro games, but Euro games especially, where in order to have satisfying combos, someone's turns have to be interminable and incredibly boring for everyone else. Wizards of the Grimoire manages to get you in like a 20 to 30 minute card game the joy of building your own combo system and then pumping it a few times, and then the game session is over and the turns are still very, very quick. And I very much appreciate that. As far as Euro style card battling goes, this is one of the best, and I really appreciate all the different effects and seeing all the different cards come up. But as I say, it takes some adaptation to get used to the different card volumes in Shifting Sands. Very highly recommended. Wizards of the Grimoire, either Shifting Sands or the base game.
So I subjected my friends to some pain, but it was unavoidable, I'm afraid.
Unavoidable? That's very strong.
Well, it was too bad. Anyway, I have very fond memories of a game called Risk 2210 AD. This came out in 2005. Then, 20 years later, they've decided to bring out an expansion called Frontline. So the original Risk 2210 AD is designed by Rob Devio and Craig Van Ness, put out by Avalon Hill. This Frontline expansion, which has four modules in it, which was pretty well based off of modules that they would hand out at tournaments and stuff, just sort of promo stuff, all sort of conglomerated together in this new expansion, was put out by Mike Gills. And I enjoyed the new experience, even like, you know, multiple years. I haven't played it in many, many years. It was unenjoyable due to the fact that I could see the people around the table were not enjoying it as much as I was. And the fact that there's very little of the expansion I thought was good. Like, the first module was the map. You know, no big deal. Maps are maps. You know, you move around. I liked the fact there was some neutral territories. That was very interesting. Sort of mixed it up. That was fine. Then they had factions. You know, everyone had a faction. Some of them seemed very unbalanced. Then we had
the tech leader.
A new leader. He was fine. No big deal. More leaders, the better. In Risk 2210, for those who don't know, because it has the word risk in it, people already pushed away. I was thinking about doing a video on this. We'll see if that ever comes out. But anyway, it's set to 5 turns. So that was the first major thing. Risk 2210 was the first risk variant that had legs. You know, people can fight me as much as they want. There was risk, then there was castle risk, and then there was Risk 2210. There was all sorts of, you know, minor ones in there that came out, but none of them had as much traction as Risk 2210. You go online and there are, you know, over 50 different modules that you can download to add to this game. So the factions weren't great. There was another module that we didn't even use that introduced amoebas that would attack random people in random areas. And I was just like, okay, well, these leader cards are bad enough for randomness. We don't need to throw in amoebas on top of it. Now, I remember using a bunch of house rules back in the day. We played it as per the rules this time. We had a silly house rule, but we had some ones that I could see me still using today. One was the energy. When you would add up all the territories you had, you'd get a certain amount of energy. When we played it back in the day, that was all of the energy you got. You would not get any energy based on territory bonus.
I see.
This would reduce the number of cards people could buy, so it wouldn't go as silly. The other thing we would do is that any troop bonuses you got for having continent bonuses had to go in those particular continents. I could go either way on that now, but definitely limiting the energy a little bit, I would keep up with. But in all, I still enjoyed playing this the new expansion, and still enjoy Risk 2210 AD.
So I don't have a lot to say on the expansion, never having played the base game. As you say, the new map seemed fine and largely unobjectionable. And the new deck of cards, along with the new leader by itself, didn't seem especially problematic because I was comparing it to the other cards. And that's my primary beef. I don't have a particular problem with the fundamental core design commitments of Risk, you know, by itself. The combat resolution mechanism, I think, is pretty good.
And yeah, I think that's what solidifies Risk overall. Just, we're going to throw a lot of dice a lot of times, and that's eventually going to even it out.
Yeah, and it's got a pretty good way to represent that as the attacker, you need to bring mass because the defender has a significant advantage, but that advantage is mitigated if the attacker has enough mass. Anyway, so I think that Risk gets a lot right, frankly, and there wasn't an obvious Australia problem in this particular map. You know, there was no continent that was only accessible through very, very narrow bottlenecks that you could just create a power base. The continents were all roughly equivalent inside, roughly, and so it didn't seem as problematic as the default game of Risk that a lot of people grew up with.
So yeah, this wasn't alternate Earth, this was actually Mars.
Yeah, yeah.
The other cool thing that Risk 2210 AD does is that it has a separate moon board, so now we had the moons of Mars. Ooh.
Yeah, and apparently, I spent the entire game without making a single Nietzsche reference or Nietzsche quote. Apparently there's a region of one of the moons of Mars called Dietzsche. Apparently there's a region of Mars called Syria, and so we looked at the map of Mars,
these are all,
and it's got like all these weird locations that none of us have heard of, and right in the middle is Syria, so naturally that caused some looking up online to figure out what that was all about. Anyway, the cards are my chief problem with how Risk 2280 works. Like, for example, one card that came up right off the beginning was you play it in response to someone declaring an attack against you. The attack is canceled, and you can't attack them for the rest of the turn. Well, if you're surrounded by that person, or if your only way to pursue necessary objectives is through that person, why would you close that off? Especially since Risk 2210 has one of the many sins of your traditional troops on a map game, which is, oh, someone's leading, someone's winning. Well, I don't have any ability to attack them. I guess I better go kick Walker in the teeth again. Because very early on, Walker got smacked upside the head with these other ridiculous cards that are called nuke cards. Apparently, I don't know a whole lot about nuclear weapon systems, but apparently the way that it works is, right, you make the warhead, right, you give it some sort of propulsion system, right, and then at that point you've run out of time, money, or space because guidance, you can't run a guidance system. You launch the bomb and you hope it lands somewhere that you'd want it to land because nukes, and we had a lot of nukes in our game. One of our factions was, we gave it to Louis, we knew that Louis would want it. It was the red faction and it launches a bunch of nukes. We knew it would make him happy, and it did. And it made him happy. And that's what matters. Nukes can't be targeted. Nukes, much of the time, sometimes it's, you know, pick a territory, they lose a D6 units. That's obnoxious in the context of Risk. And it undercuts one of the key strengths of Risk, as I say, the combat resolution mechanism. But then there are the nukes, and there are a lot of them that just say, pull a random territory. They lose a whole bunch of troops. Well, that was great. At the start of the game, Louis plays a whole bunch of nukes, because that's his faction. He gets nukes for free. Walker, with whom he shares no borders and is way off on the other side of the map, in the first turns of the game, had the majority of his forces just completely destroyed. And poor Michael Walker spent the rest of the game not only having to listen to us complain about Risk 2210, but not really ever able to mount. Like, we ignored him the entire game just because we felt bad. And he still couldn't get enough troops together to make a breakout. It was awful.
Well, the worst was after he did this randomly, he then played the nuke assassin card and decided
I forgot about that.
Take out my leader.
Yeah, he decided that. I forgot about that part too. Anyway, there's some things that are potentially interesting, like the way water areas are slightly different from land areas. Now getting to the moon is kind of a separate thing all to itself. It's potentially okay, but frankly, the cards are just all over the place and desperately unsatisfying, and so many of them are just fun killers.
And other, well, Other than the cards, I do like how the leaders work. The fact that they get to roll D8s, whereas normal in Risk, you roll some D6s, highest die wins. But if you bring your leaders along, then in some cases they get to roll D8s. And so that's kind of fun to manipulate where they are and use them as a strong front for defense and so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bias to action, but nonetheless, there's an opportunity for defense in some contexts. I think that's fine. It calls to mind in many instances my favorite Risk version, which is the Risk Mass Effect Galaxy at War game, which also had that ability to sometimes get D8s through special units, and had a team play version. The cards were much less obnoxious. Anyway, if you're at all inclined, it's heavily out of print and hard to find. But I actually think it's the best Mass Effect board game, and it is a reasonably good instantiation of the theme, and it's a really good instantiation of the mechanism's Risk. It's also the Star Wars original trilogy edition. I prefer the Mass Effect version not only because I prefer the Mass Effect license to Star Wars, I also think it's a better instantiation of the license. So they're both three-faction games. In the Mass Effect version, it is the humans, the Reapers, and, sorry, the Alliance military. My apologies, that was exceptionally racist of me. I'm sincere about
it. How dare you?
The Alliance military, primarily represented by humans, and the Reapers and Cerberus. In the context of the Star Wars original trilogy version, it is the Rebel Alliance, it is the Empire, and the Hutts, which is not as primary a mover in, you know, the original trilogy.
They could have called them Bounty Hunters. That would have been much, made more sense and been cooler.
I don't know. We're still talking about, like, leftovers, right?
Yeah.
It's not one of the core.
And the others.
Precisely. Anyway. I have nothing against Risk per se. I just think that there's a lot of things around Risk that are awful. And Risk 2210 absolutely had a lot of things around it that I thought were pretty awful. And even though it was limited to five rounds, that number one introduces a new set of problems, because there's a common issue in a lot of conflict games or war games called the end of the world problem. You know, rounds one through four, you're worried about counterattacks. You're setting yourself up for defense as well as offense. You need to worry about things. Round five, all bets are off. Tarps off, boys. You could just leave everything completely undefended because you're done and the game's over.
No, well, you need to defend, right? Because it does have a Risk 2210 does have an interesting sort of bidding mechanism where you're bidding for turn order. And so in the last round, you definitely want to go last.
Yeah.
Because you get...
It's just hugely consequential, and so, it means the last player gets to play a very different game, and it's very, very strange.
So the players that go early in the last round do need to play a little defensive, because they have to make sure that...
Yeah, yeah, some do. And then some people just get to write off defense entirely.
100%.
Which makes the final bid far too consequential. The end of the world problem is endemic in a lot of these conflict games.
Yes.
And Risk 2210 leans into it, although mostly for the people who win the bid. And then the second issue for the five turn length, it was still really long. It was very long, and no individual action was taking a whole lot of time. It's just we were moving at a relatively good clip, but it's just there's a lot going on, even though there's only five rounds. Anyway, I'm glad you still enjoy the game, Walker. I'm sorry we gave you a hard time. I just didn't see much to recommend Risk 2210.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to find a group of players that want to play it, because I don't have it here.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Even Louis, it was odd. He's one of these, he really enjoys when he gets to attack,
yep,
but then really hates it when he gets attacked. So
I don't know that was his beef. I'd have to talk to him about what his objections were. I think he mostly wanted more control over his nukes. I think that was one of the issues. And who can blame him? He's got all these nukes, but he just can't point them where he wants them pointed. And then he went into the water, and I think he regarded that as a mistake. Kind of an anti-evolutionary move. Anyway, so that was Risk 2210, specifically the Frontline expansion, designed by Mike Gills, and Renegade Game Studios now has the license. It was originally Avalon Hill, published this year. On the topic of reprints, got to play Kalamala, the new edition by Alley Cat Games. Kalamala is the first game we played by Fabio Lopiano, and now he's one of Swag's favorite designers. And Kalamala is probably his best, although I dare say that Autobahn, with which he co-designed with Nestor Mangione, is really impressive in a lot of ways, but they're very different games. Kalamala is an action selection game where every time you place a worker, you get to do both of the actions that it's between, but then everybody underneath you that went there before you also gets to do the thing. And so it's a lot of it is about timing and drafting off the actions of other players. On top of that, there's this fascinating scoring system where there are going to be these 15 scoring incidents that happen over the course of the game. They happen in a random order every game, and they get triggered once a stack gets big enough. So once a certain action space gets sufficiently well populated, then workers start triggering the scoring up there. So it's about timing, area majority, action efficiency, drafting off of other players, tons of constant player interaction, lots of weird margin calls, lots of difficulty. There's not a whole lot of infrastructure to be had. It's a very, very quick, you're already ready to go. There's going to be scoring very soon, so you better get ready or ignore it and work for later scoring opportunities. There are a lot of trade-offs and a lot of ways to do it, but it's just not a lot of resource manipulation, resource accounting. There are resources to be had, and you need to have enough of them, but that's not the focus. And that's really a breath of fresh air in a lot of games of this ilk. Unlike a lot of reprints, they have kept the incredibly standard sort of sepia, even in concept, setting of you are merchants hundreds of years ago in Europe. That's fine. But the new graphics are by Ian O'Toole, and personally, for what it's worth, I think this is some of Ian O'Toole's best work. I really like the design elements. It's all very gilt and lush, and really connotes the sort of wealth of Italian cloth merchants of the era. And I think Alicat Games did a really, really good job. The rules changes are very minor in the core game. It came with an expansion. Haven't tried the expansion yet. I have concerns. Like, for one thing, it introduces tracks, so it might be moving away from the somewhat iconoclastic nature of the original design and bring it more towards contemporary Euro sensibilities. Gotta have tracks. But I adore Kalamala. It's one of my favorite Euros. I think they did a really good job with this reprint. I'm glad it is back in print, although Alicat says they're only going to be doing crowdfunding from now on, no more retail, which is a bit of a shame. But glad to get it back to the table, and I'm glad they did it justice with this new edition.
I love Kalamala, just for the replayability, because like Mark said, there's this grid of actions, and you're placing tokens in between them. And where those actions line up are different every game, because they're tokens. So you like mix them up, and you lay them out. So in one game, there might be only two joints for one. In another game, there could be four. So deciding where to put your action token to activate the two things, I don't want to go there because that will allow everyone under the stack to also do that. So it's like, well, I don't want to go there. That will let Mark do it three more times, and I only do it once. So I'm going to manipulate it around to do it suboptimally over here by myself, and then hopefully later on, start stacking on that or entice other people to do it.
Minor emendation, Walker. You didn't go off to do it by yourself. You and Huey just kept trading actions back and forth while I was left to do it by myself. I just want the record to accurately reflect.
Pick better actions, Mark.
I just want the record to accurately reflect that no person has suffered as I have.
It's true. And it's very much action efficiency because you need buildings. You know, you get fabric, Mark, but you can only get one fabric per warehouse that you have. So if you have three warehouses, you're going to get three fabric. So it's this, do I build the factory now? I love everything about Kalamala. It's just a great game.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where you can successfully compete, even in cloth spaces, with only one workshop, never building anymore. Because the process of getting the resources and then spending them on workshops, those are resources that represent time you could have spent doing something else and resources that you could have spent elsewhere competing for victory points. And so this balance of infrastructure is very, very delicate. And there's room for lots of infrastructure. There's room for no infrastructure at all. Really well done.
So streaming this week, we streamed that Altay, the Civilization deck-building game, and then when we were done that, we played a game called Ransom Notes, House Party Edition. And this is interesting. So you have this giant bag, magnets, Mark, magnets.
Ooh.
It has magnets. I'm sorry I played a game with magnets without you. You all have this little black piece of tin that you're going to magnetize these little words to. So it's this giant bag filled with single words.
So it's like refrigerator poetry.
Yes. So you reach in and you're supposed to grab like 70. This was the irritating part. Everyone reaches in, grabs this giant handful of words. They say around 75. So everyone,
around 75.
So everyone's like trying to flip around and unstick all
you
these.
You can't say around 75.
Exactly.
That's a nonsense quantity. Nobody can look at a pile of things and say, that's more or less 75. No, it could be anywhere from 30 to 102. Yeah. Like, that's ridiculous.
I agree. That part was time consuming and was painful. And then they'll come up with the normal stuff like a beer commercial or I was trying to think of other ones that we had. I've forgotten already. Anyway, things like that. And so you're trying to arrange all these words that you have into the best sort of, cards against humanity type thing, because one person gets to sit out, which is awesome, right?
The whole judge appealing to thing.
Which,
yeah.
For whatever reason, I just hate that mechanism. It's in Cards Against Humanity. It's just a bad game in general. But in this game, the same sort of thing. One person sits out and, you sort of, I guess you just sort of have to manipulate your story or whatever you're doing, whatever game it happens to be, to situate that person that is the judge for that round.
Yeah, I agree with you. It feels unsatisfying. I mean, the number of times it gets resolved in favor of an in-joke or something weird to deliberately appeal to somebody. If the entire table is voting, that's one thing. Like, for example, critically underappreciated party game, disclosure, originally published by my friend Chris Cheslick, is called Channel A, where what you're doing is you're creating pitches for anime shows. And the entire table votes on whichever one they like, and you can't vote for your own. That's fine, because there you can't just calibrate it to satisfy one individual. It just feels like pandering. I not only does one player not get to play for a round, which is awful, but then there's often these moments where you feel like, well, I think this is the funniest, but I know they're not going to like it, so I'm just going to, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, well, that's what happened with the beer commercial, right? It was all of them were pretty good, but then someone was blah, 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 and then righteous at the end, right? It was like, oh, okay, well, you know, the person that was judging really liked that for a beer commercial, so that one won.
I don't know, that sounds pretty good to me.
And so that was Ransom Notes.
Do you prefer unrighteous beer? Is that what you're asserting?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
By Josh Roberts and published by Evan and Josh's very special games company.
We played Leviathan Wilds. This is by Justin Campanen and Moon Crab Games. We have talked a lot about Leviathan Wilds. It featured very prominently in our lists of our favorite from 2024. It is a delightful co-op with tons of great theme and lots of interesting card effects and a lot of personality. We got to clamber all over. We got to climb a whole lot. One of my criticisms of earlier Leviathans that you climb all over, you know, it's got more or less a pandemic structure in that it's about action efficiency. You need to get to the right place, throw a whole bunch of actions at a problem, then move on and go put out the next fire, as it were. But the interesting spatial element of the fact that you're climbing up and around a specific Leviathan. Some Leviathans don't really lean into this aspect of it. And you're pretty much just always just spending one action point at a time moving around. And the fact that they're standing up doesn't matter a whole heck of a lot. This one really mattered. In point of fact, there were, I'm not going to get into spoilers necessarily, but there were entirely distinct, separate areas of geography that could not be traversed except by leaping. And so, given that leaping is very difficult, we relied a lot on card effects. Sometimes we just had to throw actions at the problem. But also, on top of that, we made more strategic use of falling. Because you can, at any time while climbing, just let go and fall to the next platform. So where the next platform is matters. And I really appreciated that. I felt that this session of Leviathan Wilds, I've enjoyed all of them, but this one really leaned into the spatial aspect in a satisfying way. And so I really enjoyed it. I love trying new climbers. I love trying new professions. And that constitutes new deck combinations. I think that's really great. Very approachable rule set. Nothing too complicated, very colorful and compelling world. Leviathan Wilds is a winner. Can't wait for the new expansion materials.
Yeah, new expansion coming soon. You pick a person and they come with, you know, one or two cards, and you, like Mark said, you pick a profession. They come with the bulk of your deck. You mix those together. Gives you a different character every time, so all sorts of different combinations. And then just the normal boss, you know, they tweak it around and have little special rules each time. They have a row of cards they have to work through. You eventually learn what all those cards can do, so sometimes you can go to certain areas where they're not going to trigger on you, like you don't want to bunch up, or, you know, you make sure there's something underneath you that you can fall to. Not so much in this particular instance. We're just getting battered around quite often.
Yeah.
But it's kind of neat. You got to sort of manage your corruption as well. Some of the crystals that you're smashing will give you corruption every time you hit them. So you want to hit them less, so you hit them harder, and sort of move that around. Anyway, love Leviathan Wilds. We'll play.
Finally, we pulled out a game we have not played much recently, and it's a bit tragic. That is Regicide. I'd say it's a review copy. We have some review copies. We have a lot of copies of Regicide.
Yes.
Many of which we purchased. Many of which we received from the publisher. Regicide is by Badgers from Mars, Paul Abrahams, Luke Badger, and Andy Richdale. And it's a basic deck of cards, and it is one of the best co-ops of the past 10 years, nonetheless. The artwork, I completely forgotten how incredibly charming and detailed the artwork is. I remembered in general that I very much liked the artwork by Sketch Goblin, but I'd forgotten, like, the weird bird people, for example, and the adorable pangolin. Oh my goodness. Anyway, it is a co-op game where you're attempting to eliminate accursed nobility, but mostly it is about hand management. And despite the fact that it is a co-op with limited communicative abilities, it is nonetheless a great way to spend some time with some colleagues. And I gotta say, though, Walker, this time
I brought you down. I'm sorry.
This is the first time I've ever lost.
Yeah, I broke your streak.
I've played like 50 plus games of Regicide, and I've never come even close to losing a single game of Regicide, and you brought me low for the first time ever. You've ruined my impeccable, spotless career.
I'm so sorry.
How dare you, Walker? The listeners know that I don't lose Regicide.
Some would call me a monster, really.
Regicide is a marvelous game. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It lives forever in my purse. I'm never without a copy of Regicide nearby. And you know what? That makes me feel comfortable and safe.
Exactly.
It's been too long. We need to make sure that Regicide remains in the rotation, Walker.
Agreed. And that will probably be the case because we have a big Regicide Legacy game coming sometime soon. And I can't wait to see what they've done with that because this is very interesting. So I'd like to see what they're going to do with a Legacy version.
This is some top-notch design work. They claim it's the result of some kind of feat of inspiration or some sort of revelatory experiences. They're very humble guys. We'll see if they're able to repeat the borderline miracle that is Regicide.
Those are the games we played this week. Now, on to the news and why it does matter. But first, a quick break to pay some bills. And we're back. Mark, we loved Meltwater. A few years ago, Capstone...
Meltwater doesn't love us, though.
Meltwater does not love us. A few years ago, Capstone bought the license and said they were going to release it, and so now they are. So now we're going to have a North American release for Meltwater, a game of tactical starvation.
Oh, that is great.
By Capstone Games.
Yeah, Meltwater is such a singular design. It is described by the designer Aaron Lee Escobedo as their sad game. It really makes it... Ooh. Play it with someone you hate.
Yes.
It's so well done. It is such a great abstracted hex encounter war game system that nonetheless really makes you reevaluate your attitudes towards hostility and competition. And I'm so glad it's going to get wider exposure because Hollenspiel is a fabulous design house, but it is very niche and doesn't tend to get as much exposure as some of its designs deserve. And Meltwater is absolutely chief among them. Congress, so very wrong about games. Fun times, good vibes only. Trans Rights of Human Rights Board Game Jamboree, July 25th, 26th, and 27th in Kingston, Ontario. Open registration is now available. You can find it at Eventbrite. Go search for So Very Wrong About Games Con or just So Very Wrong About Games. We're the only ones running So Very Wrong About Games events.
That is eventbrite.com.
A link will be included in the episode notes below. And you can register for your spot at SwagCon. It's been open to patrons for a while now, but now anybody can get their own space. Remember, if it is the case that you find the registration fee, which is just to recoup our costs for the venue, if you find that burdensome, send us an email and we can give you a notional registration fee. And so you can attend anyway. We don't want anything that we do to be a barrier to people attending. The only insurmountable barrier, unfortunately, is that it will be in Kingston, Ontario. And if you can't get yourself there, we're very sorry, but there's not much we can do about that. I mean that very sincerely. I am sorry about that. It's just what it is. So that's the news and why it doesn't matter. And now we're going to move on to our topic, which is different kinds of endgame scoring and why some of them make me angry. So,
I forgot. I didn't realize there was the angry ones.
Well, okay, angry is a strong term, but I definitely think that it can lead to less than great experiences. And I would actually like to start with one that I think is really quite some nonsense.
Yeah, I have no idea why you brought this topic up. I don't know.
Yeah. So, actually, I think the best place to start, frankly, I'll table my anecdote for a few minutes because it's largely in the same category. I think we should do a deep cut, Walker, way back. In episode, I think it was episode one. Actually, let me look this up. let's go. Let's go into the history books here and see which episode this actually was. Because in the early days of So Very Wrong About Games, we had
in the before times.
Well, it's before a lot of things. We had ourselves Walker getting very, very upset, and actually, it was episode two.
Episode two.
Walker,
I know where you're going with this.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Because I actually read the rule book today for this, Mark.
Really? Why because did you do that?
Because I wanted to be able to explain, because it had been so long, why. So what you do in Bunny Kingdom.
This is Bunny Kingdom, Walker's least favorite game of all time.
Is that there is a phase of the game where you're going to choose cards and you're going to place them down. You could play some of them to help you during the game, but a lot of them are scoring opportunities. And you're just going to amass these turn by turn. And people will say, well, you know, you should have seen the cards because you're drafting them, so you're going to know. There's no way for you to know who drafted them and where they're going. That's ridiculous.
Well, and in any drafting system, there's always the possibility of someone taking it as their first pick, which means nobody's seen
them. That's what I'm saying. You might not even seen them.
Yeah.
And you don't know which player took them. So anyway, people are amassing these cards. And I there's no way for me to remember the scores of the game in question. I can only know the rules. But I'm fairly sure the end game scores are around 50. And then after these cards were counted for their points, it was around 250.
You were outraged. You were so, I remember very distinctly, the white-hot caldera of fury.
I think I was mostly angry because the actual game part of Bunny Kingdom, I very much enjoyed.
Yeah, you're a big fan of the core gameplay of Bunny Kingdom.
It had this very interesting, you know, size of your kingdom times the length and the, you know, it's been so long, I don't remember, but it was very interesting. And then they had these foolish endgame cards.
Foolish. The cards are endgame.
Ridiculous.
The endgame cards are foolish. Okay. Yeah. So what I interpreted from this is a specific disdain for how it's handled in Bunny Kingdom and a general disdain for whenever there are hidden scoring conditions that will determine the bulk of a player's score. Is that a fair characterization of what's going on?
Yes, when you go from 50 to 250, that's a little over
the top. Are you sure it's that much? I remember
it
being less than that. But
was it? All right.
Okay, the point is moot.
Yes.
So long as it exceeds what you're going to be scoring during the game, you'd rather it not work that way. I assume, just parenthetically, that if the number of points you scored during the game was trivial, like, you know, 5 to 10, and then you scored 100 or so points through in-game scoring, you would object to it less.
Yes, well, and if you could
you
sort
had
of
the illusion that you were playing a certain game where you'd be scoring points during the game, and that illusion was shattered, and your innocence was violated by that evil bunny.
But the fact that you can't, like, there are some games where you can look at the board state, and you can sort of see where people are going to score points at the end of the game.
Okay.
These were just completely hidden cards that you had no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah, okay. So this is the category that I would label as surprise.
Yes.
And when it's a negligible part, when it's not a super important part of scoring, I don't object to it too strongly. I'm never a huge fan of it. So, for example, Revive, the Kinitsia tile laying game we reviewed a few weeks ago. You pick up these goals that are worth some number of points, and they might end up in accidental competition with somebody. Like, you want to have the most pieces surrounding this cathedral, and somebody else might just so happen to be placing a lot of pieces next to the cathedral for some other reason. And so they inadvertently, through weird happenstance, end up competing with you over something. They're never going to get the points from this card for surrounding a cathedral. But you're like, oh, man. But then some other times, it just so happens that nobody cares about going next to the cathedral, and you get it easily. I'm not a huge fan of that dynamic, but when it's a negligible part of your points, I don't really care. It's fine. Whatever. We did talk about Risk 2210 this week.
We did.
And amongst the nonsense cards that got pulled, and Dewey pulled a couple of these right at the beginning of the game, are just extra points at the end of the game.
Yeah, I had 9 points.
Yep. And in the case of Dewey, he says, I didn't do a close scrutiny of what he had. He asserted that made the difference between first position and second position just by virtue of those cards. That may very well be true. I never saw any of those cards, and I wasn't last in the last round, so it doesn't matter. I was pretty much out of contention anyway, so I didn't pay attention. But Dewey asserts that the victor was determined by these cards. Not great. Not great. Especially when this dovetails with another kind of problem that I have, which is the cognitive dissonance, what I will call the cognitive dissonance category. So in Risk, the default victory conditions are holding dirt, right? And then you have these other cards that say, I'll just get, you know, random victory points added to that. It's like, well, this isn't a hand management game. This is freaking Risk. I'm holding dirt. So not only is it a surprise problem, it's also very different from the rest of what you're doing over the course of the game problem.
You could, I don't want to be the constant defender of Risk, but you could dovetail them together, whereas you know that person has to have that leader alive in order for them to score that card. So
in
the last
turn,
you could try to
given that everybody has a mittful of useless cards at the end of the game. We all had a mittful of useless cards because some of them are situational and some of them we just didn't have.
You need to guess properly, Mark.
You can look around and say, well, if I completely divert my efforts to go murk this leader way off in the corner, maybe that'll be the that's what you're suggesting?
Exactly.
Okay, I'm glad I understood. I brought this up in the context, though, of Rise and Fall. And a number of people have, there's been a discussion about Rise and Fall in our guild, and people have been commenting that yes, as you get more experience with the game, this dissonance goes down. And I agree entirely. It is indeed more easy to understand it the more familiarity you have with the system. And the more I've played Rise and Fall, and we played it a fair number of times, I indeed had a better sense of how it was going to shake out. But nonetheless, during Rise and Fall, you're playing this efficiency game, you're playing this infrastructure game, you're playing this game of manipulating what kind of units you have and what kind of resources you're going to extract. And it doesn't feel very much like an area majority contest. Yes, there's blocking, but that's usually about the efficiency problem, the resource problem, etc., etc. And then at the end of the game, there's this huge number of points that are disgorged by area majority. And I personally found it hard, even when I knew it was coming, to keep in mind in the mid-game, say, even setting aside the early game, I need to set myself up for this huge number of points that's going to come in the come after the game is over. And that kind of cognitive dissonance I find unpleasant, personally. And I prefer it when games feel a little bit more cohesive, and endgame scoring can go away towards that.
At Concordia, you might be able to say Concordia has some of that. Everyone's like,
I agree, yes.
Everyone's sort of purchasing cards, and all of these cards that the purchase have some sort of endgame scoring to them, you know, depending on how many they're buying. So trying to keep track of what people are amassing in their decks is sometimes, you know.
Even just to have a rough idea of where you're at. So by the end of a game of Concordia, there are some heuristics that are always, you always want to buy more cards. There's never a reason to disprefer having a card in your deck because they're going to give you more points. They're just going to give you options. They're not going to clog anything up because it's a hand builder game where all cards are available at all times. So go ahead, buy it. That's fine. But then if you have a fair number of cards and you might be thinking, what is worth more marginal points to me? A trading house in this place or maybe a colonist over there? Just a simple decision. The sheer amount of math necessary to calculate out what your marginal gains are from both of those two purchasing decisions, sometimes quite daunting and unpleasant. And what it leads me to do, and this is another kind of cognitive dissonance, it's just kind of dissociate from the actual details of how many points I'm going to get. And so the final score is a surprise even to me. Yeah. Oh, this card was much less valuable than I thought because my weird heuristic that I had to adopt because I didn't want to do math every time I spent a piece of cloth didn't shake out right. Okay.
I think sometimes they do this on purpose because we've seen games here where they have a score sheet, right? And it's like 18 things that you're going to write in for a score. And that's like to sort of fake away who's winning. Because I think if you knew, in some of these games, if you knew who was winning, the other players would gang up on them and therefore, you know, might manipulate how the game goes a bit. And maybe this is put in there for that reason.
Well, we can all agree, though, that the worst case scenario is where there's direct player conflict. And there is a scoreboard that doesn't matter. Like, imagine Bunny Kingdom were a war game, right? Or some sort of troops on a map game. And it's like, well, Walker's leading. And you'd be like, we don't know who's leading. Like, how could we possibly, like, yeah, I'm highest on the scoreboard, but the scoreboard doesn't really matter at all. That's one of the reasons why I actually, again, you're going to defend Risk. I'm going to defend Cosmic Encounter again. Cosmic Encounter is at least very straightforward. You have 0 to 5 foreign colonies, and ain't nothing you can tell me if you're sitting on 4 foreign colonies to explain to me that you're not winning when compared to somebody with 2 or 3 foreign colonies. It's just that easy. It's just that straightforward. And that's an entire category of endgame scoring that I really like, which is to say no endgame scoring. None. I don't think they're to all the... All endgame scoring doesn't rub me the wrong way, but I really appreciate it when a game gets to be satisfying and there's nothing.
Yeah, there's many ways to do that. It's like either, you know, all the scoring's done immediately and or there's just a straight up winning condition.
Absolutely. So games as different as, you know, Antica. That's one of the reasons why I think that Concordia is not one of Macquarie's best. I don't like the scoring system nearly as much as I do in Antica. Antica, there's a score threshold. Get to that score threshold, game's done. As a consequence, you have a little bit of the end of the world problem that I talked about in conflict games because you can absolutely leave your temples undefended in Antica in the last round. But it's not the last round by virtue of the game tempo. It's the last round because you figured out a way to win. So there in that case, it's a little bit more defensible. Galactic Renaissance, no in-game scoring. Cosmic Encounter, same thing. You hit the threshold, you did it. You got there before anybody else did. The whole race structure, I think, works really well in a lot of games, a lot of different game styles. And it's one I tend to prefer.
Even race games have that.
It's true. Well, yeah, that's what I was saying, Walker. Yeah. That's literally what I was saying. Yeah. Thank you for articulating.
No, I'm just saying there's like form of the day in all the race games. It's just, you know, first past the finish line.
Yep. First past the post. I'm a Canadian. I'm sympathetic to first past the post systems. What can I say?
And then there's ones that sort of trigger on that, the same thing, but then still give people a chance to sort of increase their score at the end. Like, you know, like Route, you know, as soon as you hit that 30 points or Hansa Teutonica, you hit that 30-point mark, and then people have a chance to, you have to finish the round out.
Not in Route.
As soon as you get past 30, you win?
Yep. Now, I think that Route has a turn order problem. It's a little bit problematic. I think I might prefer Route if they had a way to elegantly play equal turns, but setting all that aside. Yeah, Hansa Teutonica, it doesn't even always end on score. It frequently ends on other conditions as well. Well, frequently. It depends. It really depends on the overall thrust of the game. But in Hansa Teutonica, there is a fair amount of points that come in through the endgame, but it's facially obvious based on board position who's doing well. It's a little bit less clean than I might like. It's one of the least clean elements about Hansa Teutonica, you know, how transparent the scoring is. But that's not really saying much given how clean and elegant everything else is.
I know there's a few other games like Ugong, but I couldn't think of them where there's something that you have to do in the game or you don't. All the points that you've incurred don't matter, because if you don't do this one thing, then you cannot win.
Yeah, so Gugong is there. An early example of this was Quo Vadis, and now Zu Vadis is the same thing. Highest points wins, but you need to be there. A lot of the weird kind of social deduction games kind of fall into that category. Like, for example, a game that I mean to get to the table soon is 23 Knives. Either Caesar is assassinated or he's not. And then the person in that faction that has the most points, effectively, will win. But there's a similar kind of requirement.
And then there's the great, you know, Dune, right? After all this combat and everything that's happened, if the Bene Gesserit, you know, just happened to guess who's going to win, then they actually win.
Do you hate that more or less than Bunny Kingdom?
I think I would hate that more.
Have you ever played Dune?
Yes.
Okay, did it end with a Bene Gesserit victory?
No.
Okay.
But can you imagine?
Oh, I've done it. The one time I played Dune, we almost went the distance. And the big problem I have with Dune, I mean, first of all, I don't really like the license. It doesn't do much for me. It didn't do much for me before the Denis Villeneuve movie. It doesn't do much for me now. But I think that the way alliances work is super potentially interesting. I love the way the different powers combine. But there's this natural push for inexperienced players to form large coalitions, which drags the game like that because it's really hard for a three-player coalition to get all those strongholds together. Anyway, we had a position where a good friend of mine, the Rockin' one, played dumb. And it's like, I'm going to move my troops over there. And someone else was like, but if you do that, then the alliance might be able to snake a win. And he's like, well, no, I need to go do this thing. He was the Bene Gesserit, and he was deliberately leaving himself vulnerable so that
to a particular side,
so they'd win on the turn he wanted to do. I thought it was glorious. I really appreciated it for what it's worth. But I recognize how you and other people might find it frustrating. A very common dynamic that I also find frustrating, just in the sense that it changes the tenor of the game in an unsatisfying way, is when leftover resources are worth too many points and or you're too early forced into a situation where leftover resources are all you can do with your actions. So you know this dynamic, right? At the end of the game, every two money is worth a point, every cloth is worth a point, and every gold is worth 2 points or whatever. And typically, with your last action or so, you might be in a position where it's like, well, I got nothing else to do. What gives me the most money? This one does. Bang. I'll convert it for points. I've got no problem with that. What I dislike is when your last, say, 4 or 5 actions are built around that when the rest of the game wasn't. This is kind of a corollary of my objection to Rise and Fall, the way it works. And one game that I really like that nonetheless falls victim of that is The Voyages of Marco Polo. Because if you're not going to be able to satisfy those orders, the other resources are worth a fair amount of leftover points, like a non-trivial number. And it's very frequently that during the last round, you know, you've got a couple dice placements left, but all the good spaces are taken, and all you're left with is like, okay, I guess I'm just going to generate as many resources and as much money as I can. It's not as satisfying. It doesn't feel fun.
And then there's games that start you off at a huge negative, and you're just trying to get to positive points, like Feast for Odin or Agricola, Fresh Fish. These are all games that you have a negative point value, and your end game score is 3.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the case of a Fresh Fish, maybe Feast for Odin, your scores can be huge. But True. You're right. Very often in some games, and a Feast for Odin is a great example of that, your job is to avoid as much endgame scoring as possible, because so much endgame scoring in Feast for Odin can be negative. A lot of it's positive, too, like a lot of boats, a lot of colonies, a lot of this, that, and the other. But there is a whole subsection of endgame scoring that you want to avoid.
I really like games like Ark Nova and Tigris and Euphrates, where you have these multiple levers of scoring.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And your actual score is some sort of difference between them.
Yeah. Yeah, and in Tigris and Euphrates, and I can't remember exactly how it works in Ark Nova, in Tigris and Euphrates, you don't really do any in-game scoring. All you do is you allocate your treasures, but that's just purely mechanistic. It's just, you know, you allocate them in the obvious way. So there's no endgame scoring per se, but the overall rubric that you're employing for endgame scoring is fascinating. Kanitsia was infamous for this right around the turn of the century. Like Samurai in particular is similar in that it's very clever. It's a lot more in-depth, though, and some people find it very counterintuitive. It's certainly the most counterintuitive part of the game because Samurai is very straightforward. I should play Samurai again soon. Samurai is so good.
Well, it's endgame scoring and the fact that you have no idea what people's score are unless you have some sort of, you know, great memory and you've kept track of every cube that they've taken. It's sort of like endgame reveal and, you know, you tell the people how many points you have.
Sorry, what was that? I forgot what you said.
Okay. I have two games here and they're sort of in the same sort of lightweight games like Calico and or Harmonies where the entire game is so heads down, you really have no idea how many points the other players have. You're just sort of just playing and then it's just like, I have this many points. I have that, you know, it's like the big surprise what everybody has.
Yeah. And also they're both similar in that they're very, very light games in terms of rules load and super mathy in terms of calculating your final score. I'm not a huge fan of that. Like when the most mentally taxing thing, now this is not true of Calico. This is largely true of Harmonies. Harmonies is a very pleasant play experience. And then you break into hardcore math mode because the scoring is a little cumbersome. I remember back in the day when Race for the Galaxy scoring was considered cumbersome. The worst example of this, though, for what it's worth, is probably in terms of like the sheer burden of figuring out what your final score is. Probably the worst offender is Concordia, like just in terms of the difference of how hard it is to play the game versus how hard it is to score it. But another game that's much heavier to play and also very, very unfortunate to score is Imperium. Imperium Legends, Imperium Classics, Imperium Horizons. Scoring that game, I love the game. It's one of my favorites. It's such a pain to score. Oh my goodness.
I love the scoring in Scythe. I love the fact that you have this sort of favoritism track that you're trying to work down and it's just going to increase what's scoring more and more for you. So the more hearts you have, it's going to give you a better multiplier for all of the scoring conditions. And I just really like how that works out because it's sort of like a hard...
Even leftover resources. Yeah, everything. Yeah. Literally everything can be influenced.
And it's this hard decision throughout the game is that it's like, I could do this that will, you know, really benefit me, you know, map-wise or resource-wise, but I really need to start working up this track.
Yeah, every popularity hit. It's weird because popularity in a very real way is more consequential than actual points, but it is not points in and of itself. The only thing that is not affected by popularity is just your sheer leftover cash, which may be significant. I mean, Scythe is an interesting case because sometimes the bulk of your scoring is going to be endgame scoring. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes the bulk of it's going to be stuff that you're going to get at the end. And every popularity hit is so hard. What I really respect about Scythe players that do a lot better than I do when playing Scythe is they know when to take that popularity hit. I just operate on a simple heuristic. Never lose popularity. Ever. Because it's so important. Which is obviously not the best way to thrive, because sometimes it's worth losing it. Because I do maintain that in that sense, Scythe is probably better balanced than I give it credit for. I'm just loss averse.
Sort of why I like Orleans as well, because you're like sort of collecting these stars and or citizens, and you're putting out settlements, and in themselves are not technically worth points, but at the end of the game they multiply together in a way that will get you points. Same sort of thing, but slightly different.
Actually, going back to an earlier category, I just thought of another game I really love that kind of does a little bit of the surprise version, which is Raw. It is so easy to forget when playing Raw that you're going to be scoring for leftover suns at the end of the game. Now, in fairness, this is not quite as bad as shifting gears radically, because you always care about how much currency you have going into the next round. So in point of fact, the sun scoring is kind of avoiding an economic version of the end of the world problem. But it is very easy to underestimate the effect of ending the game with a very, very weak hand of suns. Those 5 points can make a huge difference.
So I'm very, very interested in what you guys think. What is your, what end game scoring do you hate? You can let us know. We got a
or love. Walker. Or love. Why you got to be so negative? Walker.
Or love. Mark will read those ones. We have a board game guild on Board Game Geek. You can let us know there. You can also get onto our Discord. Send us an email. Happy to know what you think.
And with that, we are going to close it out for this week for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you so, so much for joining us. We appreciate your deciding to spend the time. Please do take care of yourselves. Self-care is an obligation. Take care of your hobby. And thank your rules explainer. Take care, everyone.
Peace.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here,
reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion,
or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.